from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents The Broken Promise of Brown by Julian Bond, Chairman, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, on Friday, April 2nd at 7:30 p.m. in the auditorium of Smith Memorial Hall, 805 South Matthews Avenue, Urbana, on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Throughout the year, from time to time, we discuss various health topics. Of course, on a regular basis, we have physicians on the program to answer questions. And then also, we do pick out particular topics that we think are important and you should know about. And at least once or twice a year, we try to talk about them. And this morning, we'll be taking up a subject we have discussed before on the show and deliberately put into the rotation because it's something that you certainly should be aware of, and it's something that is becoming increasingly common in the American population, and that is diabetes. It's estimated now, and I think the figure that I saw on the website of the Diabetes Association, that something more than 18 million Americans have diabetes, and that there are a lot of people who have the disease and do not know it. It has not yet been diagnosed, and they're not receiving any care from a physician. Early on, the symptoms can seem to be benign, but left untreated, diabetes can affect the body in many different and seriously serious ways. So this morning, we will try and cover some of the basics and also invite people to call in with questions. Our guest is Sandy Burke. She is a nurse practitioner and also teaching associate in the University of Illinois College of Nursing. And we're pleased to have her here. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
For being here. And let me tell people who are listening, of course, the number, same as always, if you'd like to call in with questions, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Well, I guess one of the things that certainly is important to mention right at the beginning is that the incidence of diabetes, the number of people who have diabetes, is going up and apparently has been increasing fairly steadily. At least the diagnosis has been increasing fairly steadily over the last several decades, I think.
Absolutely, it has. In fact, diabetes is considered to be at epidemic proportions now in all age groups, but particularly increasing in children and youth.
So how is there some number that's been put on the number of people who have diabetes and yet have not been diagnosed?
Roughly about a third of that 18 million that you were talking about are undiagnosed as yet.
So that's a lot of people. That's a significant number of
people. Sure is. Yeah.
What are the – well, maybe the thing to do would be first to talk a little bit about the types of diabetes. And this is something that people may have heard about, that there are these basically two called type 1 and type 2, and that we used to refer to them as juvenile diabetes and adult diabetes. And I think we've gotten away somewhat from those terms, because particularly with type 2, calling it adult, put that in quotes, with what we're seeing now, that's a mislabeling. But let's look at the other one first and talk about the difference between the two. What is type 1 diabetes?
Type 1 diabetes, or what was formerly called juvenile diabetes, is more common in children and young adults in the early stages, but it actually can be diagnosed at any time during the lifespan. So no one is really immune from type 1. It is typically, it's what's called an autoimmune disease. And what that means is that the body, for reasons that are still not clearly understood, destroys its own insulin-making cells. And so these folks, right from the very beginning, need to take insulin, which is why it sometimes is called insulin-dependent. That also is an old term. And type 1 is really it only affects about a half million to a million people in the U.S. right now. So it's by far and away the the lower number of people with diabetes. But those folks who have type 1 know it right from the beginning. There's no escaping that they have diabetes. When they're diagnosed, they usually have lost a significant amount of weight. They have frequent thirst, frequent urination, sometimes blurred vision, extreme fatigue. And those symptoms take them to their doctor, their healthcare provider.
Mm-hmm. There, and so the reason, perhaps the reason for greater concern, I don't want to take anything away from how serious that would be with people who have type 1 diabetes, but the reason perhaps for the greater concern is type 2, particularly because it can be very quiet and that people might have it and the symptoms might persist, or they might be in this sort of pre-diabetic phase, which we're starting to hear more about, and that they just don't know it. And that the longer that goes, the longer it's left untreated, the more potentially serious consequences there are going to be.
Absolutely. Type 2 diabetes has often been called a silent killer because it is very insidious. It may start with the blood sugar being slightly higher than normal, and over a couple of years, over a span of anywhere from 2 to 10 years perhaps, the glucose level, the sugar level, begins to get higher and higher and higher. The body tolerates it until it can no longer tolerate it, and those same symptoms, frequent thirst, frequent urination, etc., come on. The problem with type 2 diabetes, there are so many problems, but I think one of the biggest problems, David, is that people think that because you don't need insulin right from the beginning, it's a less serious illness, and that is such a terrible misconception. Mm-hmm. If you have diabetes and it's not controlled, whether it's type 1 or type 2, doesn't matter. They both lead to the same kinds of chronic consequences. People with diabetes are much more prone to have a heart attack, 2 to 4 times more likely to have heart disease than people without diabetes, and that's particularly true in women. People with diabetes are more likely to have kidney failure and lose limbs, so and go blind. So it's a very serious illness, whether it's type 1 or type 2.
Do most people who are initially diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and at the beginning are told that it can be controlled or at least addressed by diet and lifestyle modifications, how many of those people do eventually, though, get to the point where they do need to have insulin? Does everybody eventually get to the point where they have to have insulin?
My knee-jerk reaction is yes, everybody needs insulin at some point in time. But the research is pretty clear that of the people with type 2 right now, roughly about a third are controlling it with meal plan and exercise. Another third are on pills, and another third are on insulin. What we learned a couple of years ago from a study called the United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes, UKPDS, Prospective Diabetes Study, is that type 2 diabetes is a progressive disease and that there are two components to it. One of those components is insulin resistance, and that means that your body's own insulin is there, it just doesn't work properly. The other component is that over time, your body makes less and less insulin. And so as time goes on, it's suspected that most, if not all, people with type 2 diabetes would need insulin.
Hmm. Maybe I should just very quickly introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Sandy Burke. She is a nurse practitioner and also teaching associate in the College of Nursing here at U of I. We're talking about diabetes, and questions are certainly welcome. You want to pick up the phone and give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Maybe we should take a step back here and talk a little bit more about with diabetes, what's going on in the body. I'm not sure how well people understand it. I'm not sure that I do either. I know that they know that it has something to do with sugar, but I'm not sure past that. And people maybe think, well, it has something to do with eating too much sugar, or and they do sort of understand it has something to do with the way the body processes sugar. But past that, I'm sure most people don't. They couldn't really tell you, well, what exactly is happening? Can you, for the layperson who is not all that highly informed on physiology, really what in the body is what's happening?
Your body makes a couple of different hormones that control the amount of sugar or glucose that is constantly present in the bloodstream. When you eat something, anything at all, it turns into simple food things. So our main nutrients are carbohydrates, which turn into glucose, and protein become building blocks, amino acids, and fats that become smaller fats called lipids or triglycerides. All of these different substances have an effect on the sugar level in the blood, but carbohydrates have the primary effect. When you eat that food, whatever it is, you know, a turkey sandwich, a bag of M&Ms, whatever you choose to eat, your body takes it, turns it into those simple parts in a fairly short period of time. And as soon as the body, the brain, senses that there is an excess of glucose in the blood, it releases a hormone called insulin from the pancreas. Insulin's job primarily is to take that glucose out of the blood and put it in a place where the body can either use it right away or save it so that the sugar can be used later for energy. Sugar is our primary source of energy, so we need carbohydrates in the diet. So the issue with diabetes is what's happening with that sugar system. And the problem is either one of two things. In type 1 diabetes, the body stops making the hormone insulin, and there's nothing to prevent that sugar from continuing to go higher and higher and higher. In type 2 diabetes, the body continues to make the hormone insulin, but for reasons that occur at an individual cell level, the fat cells, the muscle cells in the body, don't use the insulin properly. And so because of that, the sugar, some of it gets into the body's cells and can be used, but most of it doesn't. Most of it stays in the blood and gradually goes higher and higher. And normally, in people without diabetes, the sugar level is going to stay higher than 60, not higher than 100, and maybe go up 20 or 30 points after eating anything. When you have diabetes, the baseline, the bottom line blood sugar is not controlled, so that unless you are doing something actively to control it, taking insulin, taking pills, a combination of that, working on a meal plan, using those lifestyle modification therapies that you were talking about earlier, if you're doing something actively, you can control how high that blood sugar gets. But if you're not, then the sugar continues to rise to sometimes extremely high levels. We consider that normal blood sugar runs from 60 to 100. If you have diabetes, we recommend, and we being the American Diabetes Association, recommends that the glucose level is stabilized not lower than 90 and not higher than 130. On most home monitoring systems, that translates to a lab value of 80 to 120.
Mm-hmm. What are the major risk factors for type 2 diabetes?
Well, interestingly, the incidence of type 2 diabetes has increased as the proportion of body weight has increased in the U.S. So the primary risk factor for developing type 2 diabetes is weight. The more you weigh, the more likely you are to have diabetes. But weight in and of itself doesn't cause diabetes. You also have to have a genetic predisposition. Type 2 diabetes seems to run very heavily in families.
Okay. Well, the concern, though, is that here is one of the yet another reason that we have to be concerned that overall the population seems to be getting heavier, because it's one of the risk factors for diabetes. And this is, it gets us into the concern now about young people, adolescents, kids, young adults, that we are starting to see in this age group a growing diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, that we didn't see that much before. We generally thought of this as being the kind of thing that you start to see in people when they get to be maybe sort of middle-aged to older. That's why it was called adult onset, because we just didn't think that it was something that affected children.
Absolutely.
But this now has become a real concern, and that a lot of it does seem to be kids who are were too heavy, and they're not getting a lot of exercise, and maybe the quality of their diet is not real great. And that's one, in addition to those other sorts of things that are associated with that. This is a real reason, apparently, for concern.
It's a very real concern. 10 years ago, only about 4% of the children who were diagnosed with diabetes had type 2, were clearly identified as having type 2. as of 1999, I think, that number had risen to 16%. So in a very short period of time, those numbers are increasing remarkably, and it's very, very scary. Mm-hmm.
So anybody who knows that they have family history of diabetes, that would be one reason for them to be concerned. But I guess I go back to this, when we started out talking about the fact that there are more than 18 million people in the United States who have diabetes, and something like a third don't know it. So obviously there are people who either maybe they don't have a family history, or they're not really aware of it, and are just not, they're not conscious of the fact that perhaps they are at risk.
They may not have symptoms. They may not have symptoms from the time that their blood sugar is higher than normal until it's well over 200. Mm-hmm. And so that there's a gray period in there when the sugar level is clearly higher than normal and doing damage to the internal organs, and yet the person is unaware. And sometimes people are not seeking care because they really have no access. And other times they have no awareness of what they're dealing with. But again, you know, those classic symptoms, frequent thirst, frequent urination, extreme fatigue, blurred vision, those things are very much associated with uncontrolled diabetes.
Yeah. And those would be the things that to watch out for, but you well could either not maybe attribute them to something else, or just not really think about those things.
Yes, and often when those symptoms occur and you have type 2 diabetes, you already have some of the chronic complications developing. So it's a good idea to see your doctor, nurse practitioner on an annual basis just to check base, make sure that your glucose level is normal.
Mm-hmm. And the main way of doing that is to do a blood test?
Yes, a very simple blood
test.
So
it's very easy. Just the thing is that you have to be fasting. So you have to go for a period of time not having eaten, and then have the blood test and see what the blood sugar level is.
Ideally, that's great. Mm-hmm. You do not need to be fasting if you have symptoms. We can tell if the blood sugar is over 200 and you have the classic symptoms. There really are no other tests that need to be done. If you have a blood sugar level higher than 126 on two separate occasions, and this is not a finger stick, but actually a needle stick into the arm where they draw the blood and analyze it in a lab. If that glucose level is higher than 126 on two or more occasions, even without symptoms, that's diagnostic of diabetes.
Mm-hmm. What are the recommendations for screening? Is the recommendation that everyone at some particular interval should have a blood draw and have their blood sugar checked?
Actually, no. The recommendations for screening are a little murky right now. So the bottom line is that if you have a family history of diabetes, then you should be talking to your doctor on an annual basis, because that glucose test, that blood sugar test, is actually part of a panel that's combined with a number of other things that many doctors check on an annual basis all the time. You just need to ask the question, what was my blood sugar this year?
Okay. We have a couple callers and other people certainly who are listening. If you have questions, you should feel welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go first to a caller in Indiana on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The increased thirst and increased urination and the fatigue, are there any other subtle disarrangements that one might notice? When you mentioned one-third of the people don't even know they have it, I was beginning to think there must be something awful subtle, and other than they're not having an annual checkup with blood tests or something. I just wonder if there were more than just those main three, something that's, maybe changes in feeling of the legs or outer extremities or something like that.
That's a really good point. There are some more subtle things to look for, including a delayed healing in simple cuts and wounds. People with higher than normal blood sugar levels also tend to develop infections more frequently than others. So if you have more chronic or acute infections than anyone else that you know, that could be something to look for as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and we'll go next to a caller in Aurora on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Very, very timely topic. I wish it wasn't, but it is in America. I heard that there are three symptoms that if you take your child to the doctor and have those three symptoms, they should be checked. If the child is obese, if there's a history of diabetes in the family, and could you tell me what the third one is?
Well, it's a stretch for me. I'm wondering whether or not it has something to do with blood pressure, but that's a sign, not a symptom. So the things that we look for in children are level of exercise and body
weight.
What do you mean
level of exercise?
I mean, do they exercise at all? You know.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
There are kids who spend most of their time exercising their thumbs than, with video games, than exercising
yes,
their bodies.
Yes,
and.
Yes.
Television time has a great deal to do with body weight. So,
yes, it does.
Yeah, so exercise and physical body weight and family history of diabetes are three things that we definitely look for.
I wanted to say also that I have a niece that had pains in her, I don't know exactly where, but her abdominal area for many, many years. And she went for tests. She went to the hospital with the pain, and it went on and on and on. And finally, last year, they decided to take her gallbladder out because they thought that could be the problem. And that didn't help, and she still had the pain. And after all those years, she finally went to one doctor, and they found out that the pancreas was diseased. After all those years, and had it remove it, and of course she has what she called surgical diabetes, which is horrendous to treat. Horrendous. Her blood sugar will go up to 600 in 2 hours.
When you have your pancreas removed, it causes type 1 diabetes surgically because there, again, is nothing, there is no insulin available, and it indeed is very difficult to manage because...
Very, very. It's just been horrendous to hear what is going on with her. And I guess I just tell the story, if anybody has any kind of pain, you know, try to have it checked. I mean, she did. She was in the hospital all the time. It was just a sad thing that it couldn't be found sooner. Thank you so much.
All right.
You're
well,
welcome.
Thanks for the call. We'll go on to another caller. We have someone on the cell phone here, and that would be line number 2. Hello. Is there a caller there on line 2?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could clear up some confusion I have about the significance of syndrome EPS and insulin intolerance and how this plays into diabetes. And I will just take my answer over the radio.
All right. Well, thanks for the
call.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking. Syndrome X, or what's now called metabolic syndrome, is a cluster of a variety of different kinds of things that happen in the body, not the least of which is high blood sugar, hyperglycemia. But it also goes along with high lipids, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, and a couple of other metabolic things that are happening in the body system. Insulin resistance is part of the process that goes along with that. So that's usually one of the things that we think about in terms of type 2 diabetes, is the insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome. And we try to treat all of the pieces of that so that we're not just controlling diabetes, but we're also reducing serum lipid levels, so getting the cholesterol level down. We're controlling the blood pressure, and all of it is aimed at reducing the possibility for early heart disease.
Okay. Well, I hope that gets at the questions, the caller's question. Let's go on to line number 1. This is Urbana.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if a skinny person could get diabetes.
Absolutely. And in fact, skinny people can even get type 2 diabetes. Most of the people with type 2 have our overweight or obese diagnosis, but there's a variant, a classification of type 2 diabetes called lean type 2. Everything has to do with how your body is processing sugar. So, yes, you can. If you're skinny to start out with and have no family history, then it's possible that you might develop type 1 diabetes rather than type 2, but either type is possible.
And tell me again the difference between 1 and 2.
In type 1, the body stops making insulin so that the pancreatic cells, called the beta cells, don't function. And because of that, there's nothing that can control the sugar level in the blood. In type 2 diabetes, the body makes insulin, it just doesn't use it properly.
I see. Okay, but a skinny person, you think if a person is skinny, they aren't eating all that junk that causes diabetes.
Well, remember that there's a genetic component to it as well. So it's not just about food. It's also about how your body is responding.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have talked about type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and there is one more category that we ought to mention, and that is gestational diabetes. And it is possible some women in pregnancy develop diabetes. In some cases, I guess in many cases, once they deliver, that goes away, but I guess that also having had gestational diabetes does increase your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So it is something that you still need to take seriously, even if it seems like after the baby is born, it goes away.
Yes. Gestational diabetes is the only kind of diabetes that we say goes away, and that's a very sticky thing to say, because it does in fact come back, or it has the potential to come back in all women. Whether or not you develop gestational diabetes has a lot to do with, again, your body weight, but your genetics. So if you have had a family history of diabetes, type 2 diabetes in particular, then you have a greater risk of having gestational diabetes during any pregnancy. If you are overweight and have a family history, then your odds go up. So it's the same sort of clinical picture that we look at for type 2, but the thing that brings it on a little bit faster is the hormonal stress of the pregnancy. So because of the change in the hormones, the blood sugar goes up during pregnancy. Once those hormones are back in their normal fashion, then the blood sugars tend to go back down in most women, but it can come back.
Another caller here in Urbana, line 1.
Hi.
Yes.
I just had a quick question. You're talking about diabetic problems. I'm wondering if there's any problem with hypoglycemia, with somebody that doesn't have a problem with high blood sugar but with low blood sugar, or is that not a concern? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you for the question. The issue with low blood sugars is not as clear as with high blood sugars. We can very clearly diagnose diabetes, but it's harder to diagnose what's called reactive hypoglycemia. Most of the time when people have hypoglycemia, they actually have symptoms of feeling very shaky, sweaty, hungry, weak, maybe a little more irritable than normal. And those episodes happen between meals. And they also happen depending upon how what you put into your meal plan. So if your diet is mostly, not low density food, it doesn't have a lot of kick to it. It's just got empty calories, that sort of thing. Then you may be more likely to have episodes of hypoglycemia. That's, as I said, harder to diagnose, but a doctor can certainly do that. It's often diagnosed based on symptoms. There are some rare disorders that can cause serious hypoglycemia, and I'm thinking about what are called insulinomas, a kind of a tumor on the pancreas. Very, very rare, but that could cause something like hypoglycemia as well. More commonly, people who have the tendency to develop type 2 diabetes, who have higher than normal insulin levels in their system before they're diagnosed, may have periods of hypoglycemia and then actually go on to develop type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you experience those symptoms, is that something that you should be talking about with the doctor about?
Absolutely, you should. And what often they will recommend is that you see a qualified dietitian who can talk to you about how to put your food together in such a way to minimize those symptoms.
Mm-hmm. When you have someone who is diagnosed with type 2 diabetes initially, when you first start thinking about, what are the most basic and kind of least invasive sort of ways we can treat this, particularly if you have somebody who is overweight.
Mm-hmm.
First things you're going to say is, well, two things you're going to need to do. You need to get to what should be your ideal weight, and we need to get you some exercise. How many people, at least initially, could have some benefit just from that and for a while maybe hold off on starting on any kind of medication?
All people with type 2 diabetes benefit from a meal plan. All people with type 1 diabetes benefit from a meal plan. The question is how long you can do what is recommended and how willing you are to make those kinds of lifestyle changes. Mm. We don't live in a society that's very willing to make changes, so it's very difficult to do that. But the reality is that it doesn't take a great deal of weight loss to get that blood sugar back to normal. In a recent study called the Diabetes Prevention Program, we found that lifestyle modifications actually that translated into a weight loss of about 5 to 10% of body weight. That's not very much. Mm-hmm. Actually normalized those blood sugars, so it delayed the onset of type 2 diabetes. So if people who have diabetes are following a good solid meal plan, and I strongly encourage people to see a qualified dietitian to get the right kind of diet. There is no one-size-fits-all diet. There needs to be just a tailored program that fits well with that particular individual, that meets their needs and the needs of the diabetes as well. So see a qualified dietitian and exercise to control the blood sugars. And sometimes that can control it for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. So the kind of diet that you're talking about, is this something that would be different from a healthy kind of balanced diet that you would prescribe for somebody whose issue simply was weight and needed to lose some weight?
It's exactly the same kind of diet. It's a well-balanced meal plan. It contains all of the nutrients in the right amounts.
Let's talk with another caller here. This is also someone in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to have you explain the differences in the results of two kinds of blood sugar tests. One is the normal glucose fasting test, and the other is a hemoglobin 1C. And I know the hemoglobin 1C tests blood sugar over a longer period of time, but do those two always correspond? Are there some discrepancies? Is one more important? I'd like to hear you talk about that. Thank you.
Okay.
The best way to answer that is to look at a fasting blood sugar as being a snapshot in time, so that when you actually do a blood test and see what the level of glucose is at the moment, then you're looking at just that moment. But you have to realize that your blood sugar changes throughout the day, throughout the night, and it's going to vary from time to time. So that if you even tested the blood sugar in the same person every 5 minutes over a period of an hour, that number would vary little by little because of the normal changes in the glucose. That's the normal glucose. The hemoglobin A1C actually measures the amount of sugar, glucose, that adheres to the hemoglobin molecule in the red blood cell. And since the red blood cell has a lifespan, it lives in the body for about 3 or 4 months, we can tell what the average, it's a weighted average, of blood sugar is over the previous 3 to 4 month period of time. If you wanted to compare those two numbers, you'd have to think about what you were comparing. The hemoglobin A1C is measured in a percentage. The glucose level is actually measured in an actual number. It's actually milligrams per deciliter of blood. We say that a normal hemoglobin A1C in somebody without diabetes will run from about 4 to 6% or thereabout. And that is equivalent to normal blood sugar, somewhere between 60 and 100. And that 1% of hemoglobin A1C is roughly equivalent to 30 points of sugar.
Okay, so that, but what happens if the moment in time blood sugar fasting is a little over 100, but the A1C is like 4.6 or 5 or something that's low, then what does that mean?
Well, It means that if the hemoglobin A1C is within normal limits, it means that the body is using the sugar appropriately most of the time. If when you have your glucose level done, and it's done in a lab, not a finger stick, finger stick blood tests are different and less reliable than lab blood tests. But if you have the test done in a lab and it's slightly over 100, it may mean that you have what David was calling earlier is pre-diabetes. It's a new term that we've been using in the last couple of years. It may mean that you are predisposed to develop diabetes, but that you do not yet have it.
Okay. But then if the hemoglobin A1C shows that you don't have it, that means you don't have it yet.
Well, the hemoglobin A1C in the U.S. is not a diagnostic test, and that means that we don't diagnose diabetes based on the hemoglobin A1C. We diagnose it based on the actual blood sugar, so either a fasting or a random plasma glucose level.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Our guest this morning is Sandy Burke. She's a nurse practitioner and teaching associate in the U of I College of Nursing here in Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about diabetes. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How do we define pre-diabetes?
Pre-diabetes doesn't have as much of a meaning from the medical standpoint as it does from the popular standpoint. Prediabetes means that, in fact, you are predisposed to develop type 2. And what it means clinically is what we call either impaired fasting glucose or impaired glucose tolerance. And so we actually have a diagnostic code for impaired fasting glucose, and that means that your sugar level is higher than normal, higher than 100, but less than diagnostic. So it's between 100 and 125. So if you're in that very gray area, it means that you can actually do quite a lot to delay the ultimate diagnosis of diabetes. And again, it goes back to following some sort of reasonable meal plan and exercising more often.
So if you are one of those people who had family history, and then you go and you have your blood sugar tested, and you get a reading like that where it's higher than normal, but not at the level of being diagnosing and saying, okay, you have diabetes, then that person should be taking the steps to lower their risk or at least slow down the development of the disease. And it sounds like it wouldn't, at that point, wouldn't really be all that hard, because we'd still be talking about basically the lifestyle modifications, the sensible diet, appropriate weight, exercise kind of things that probably are not only good for preventing diabetes, but lowering your risk of a lot of other stuff too.
Good for your heart, good for your blood pressure, good for everything that you can think of. Mm. Absolutely.
We have some other callers. Champagne, next, line one. Hello.
Hello, I'm calling to see, is there a racial component to diabetes, namely, are racial groups such as African Americans and or Native Americans, for example, disproportionately at risk for diabetes as opposed to other racial groups or ethnic groups?
What a good question. Absolutely they are. All people of color have a higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes. In fact, African Americans, Native Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asians and Pacific Islanders all have a higher risk for developing type 2 diabetes.
Is there a medical reason for that?
I think we're still looking for it.
Okay.
I think it's a genetic reason that we're still looking for.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Chicago, line four. Hello.
I have a close relative who has diabetes, and I have a couple questions regarding the dietary aspect. I've noticed that when there's not only high carbohydrates but also high fat in the diet, the level seems to go up the next morning when the test is done. And I think a lot of people just associate with sugar in the diet, but I noticed that also that whenever there's a high fat content in the diet, and also I've noticed that a high fiber diet tends to lower the blood sugar reading. Is this consistent with the research on that?
Absolutely it is. When you have a diet that is high in fat, fat tends to slow the absorption of the other nutrients, and so you may not have as high of a blood sugar immediately after the meal, but the blood sugar stays higher for a longer period of time. And fiber is something that that mediates the effect of glucose in the system. So adding fiber to the diet is a good way to keep the blood sugar from getting too high after eating.
Do you think this this craze with the Atkins diet, which is mainly high protein, but usually protein is associated with a lot of fatty foods, do you think that puts more people at risk from this diabetes?
I will tell you that the party line from the American Diabetes Association is very clear on this. Fad diets don't work. They don't work because people don't stay with them long enough to maintain over a period of time. I'll tell you that personally, I have not seen much success long-term with any kind of fad diet, even the Atkins diet. And that from my standpoint, when I talk to people who have diabetes, I worry about their kidney function, and high-protein diets are harder on kidney function than low-protein diets are. And in terms of the normal or the well-balanced diet from diabetes, it's not necessarily low-protein. It's just a well-balanced plan that tends to have about 40 to 55% carbohydrates, so roughly about half of the calories are from carbohydrate. The body gets calories, gets sugar easily from a carbohydrate source. It's just harder to get those calories from other sources.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. You know, this is one of the things I wanted to ask you about because a number of years ago, I talked with a physician who had written a book advocating a particular kind of diet for people who are diabetic that was severely carbohydrate restricted, which sounded to me like it wouldn't have been very much fun because it meant you couldn't have any bread, you couldn't have any pasta, you couldn't have any rice, you couldn't have any potatoes. I'm not sure what it was you could eat, but it was severely restricted on carbs. And this the author claimed that he had people who had been insulin dependent. When he put them on this diet, they didn't have to take their insulin anymore. And I guess I wasn't really, you know, not being an expert in the field, I wasn't really quite sure how to take it. But that was his thing. And I wonder, have you had some experience with those kind of diets and what you think about them?
Well, I've never used those kinds of diets with my patients. And there are any number of reasons for that. But I'll tell you that if you have true insulin-dependent diabetes, that's type 1 diabetes. And if you don't take insulin when you have type 1 diabetes, your body will starve to death, regardless of what kind of diet you're on. So if it's true type 1, there is no getting around it. You must have insulin in one form or another, to our knowledge as of today. Mm-hmm. When you have type 2 diabetes, you may be taking insulin for control. And if you are, then there are diets that will cause weight loss. And the weight loss that you experience will reduce your insulin resistance, and that in turn may cause you to no longer need insulin. That's certainly true regardless of the kind of diet that you're on. If you're on a well-balanced meal plan and are following that routinely with a good solid exercise program and you lose weight, you may not need insulin if you have type 2 diabetes also. Okay.
We have about 12 minutes left again with Sandy Burke from the U of I College of Nursing. She's a nurse practitioner and also teaching associate. We're talking about diabetes, and questions are welcome. We have some other folks here. The next is in Utica, and that's line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think 3/4 of my questions were answered by the last two people who called in. But my question is that the person who's on the high-protein diet, can you safely assume that protein does not impact blood sugar?
No, protein will impact blood sugar. It just won't have as dramatic an effect as carbohydrate will. So you'll have lower blood sugars, but you'll still have an effect.
Is it? I take it it's not a great effect.
You know, I don't know how to answer that question. again, it's lack of experience on my part with people who are on an Atkins-type diet, so I haven't seen it clinically. I can tell you that what I have read suggests that protein will raise the blood sugar. There's actually about 4 grams of carbohydrate in every ounce of meat, something like that. I'm not a dietitian, so that's a stretch for me to try to remember that. But there is a little bit of carbohydrate in protein. It's just not very much. And so you're not going to have an extreme increase in your blood sugar.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, and let's see. We'll go here back to line number 3 and the caller in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. I heard you say that the target glucose reading is 90 to 130, and then you said something about a lab translates to a lab figure?
Yes. When you're monitoring your blood sugar at home, you're using what's called when you're monitoring your sugar at home, you're using plasma-referenced methodology now. So 90 to 130 is 90 to 130 with plasma. What we used to do is use whole blood at home, and that was 80 to 120. So I think I misled you earlier.
And you've done a really good job here, so I wouldn't feel too bad about it. But I want to ask you my big question is, I don't really understand what the diet is supposed to do. I understand that if you have high sugar, you can get a lot of infections. That I get, and I understand the mechanism there. But so what if you have low in your diet, if you have low carbohydrates and sugars? I mean, what exactly does that help? How does that help a diabetic?
If you have a well-balanced meal plan, that translates to mean that you have the right amount of carbohydrate, the right amount of protein, the right amount of fat, all of the vitamins and minerals that are necessary to keep your body functioning properly, so that your cells need energy. They get that energy from carbohydrate. Your cells need building blocks, and they get those building blocks from the fats and the proteins. And so in order for your body to work properly, you have to have all different kinds of nutrients. If you have diabetes and you don't have the right kinds of nutrients, then you may not have the right kinds of building blocks to maintain a healthy life.
Yeah, but let's say you have all the minimum requirements of fats and proteins and also a lot of sugar. I mean, would that really be a problem?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're asking specifically, you know, is there a problem with eating sugar?
Well, I guess, but I understand that the problem is too much sugar in the blood. But they don't. Nobody ever really explains why that would be a problem. You know, I mean,
okay. You
can. You're right about. I mean, I get the idea that you need the normal building blocks, and if all you did was eat sugar, you'd have a real problem. But let's say you get the minimum of everything you need, and then too much sugar. Why is that a problem?
Okay, let me answer that in two parts. First, that there really is no such thing as a bad food. It's all about common sense and moderation. So that if you eat sugar and you happen to be the kind of person who's taking insulin, you should take the right amount of insulin for what you're eating, regardless of what it is you're eating, so that you're protecting your body from too much sugar in the bloodstream all at once. Now, that's the first part. The second part of the question is, if you're eating things that cause the blood sugar to be too high, regardless of what that is, and that could just be a really big Thanksgiving meal. You know, you've just got too much of everything, but the sugar level in the blood goes too high. If the sugar level in the blood is too high for too long of a period of time, that actually does damage to the body's cells, so that you can suffer the chronic complications of diabetes. And that's not something that happens in a day or a week or a month. That takes years of chronically high blood sugars for those complications to occur. It translates into a higher risk for heart disease, a higher risk for blindness, a higher risk for kidney disease, kidney failure, and a higher risk for nerve fiber disease. All of those things are possible with chronically high sugar levels.
But it doesn't sound as if anybody really knows the exact mechanism. They just know that if there's high sugar, it damages cells.
Actually, they have a pretty good idea of some of those exact mechanisms. And depending upon the system that they're talking about, it's a different mechanism. In the kidney, it has to do with wearing away at what's called the basement membrane. In the eyes, it has to do with the kind of chemical that's involved. In the heart, it has to do with a combination of the bad lipids versus the good lipids. So there's a lot of good data out there.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll try and get real quick one more call. Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. I got in late on your show. On, is it Miss Burke or Sandy?
Sandy is fine.
Oh, okay. Anyway, a friend in my neighborhood got pretty well wiped out with this diabetes situation, and through several findings and nutrients and so forth, he had tremendous luck with flax oil and cottage cheese. And I'm not trying to sell anything to you, trust me, but it was through a lady who was in this magazine, and her name was Dr. Johanna Budwig. Have you ever heard of her?
No, I have not.
She's over in Germany, and she swears by that it helps alleviate heart cancer and diabetes. And it worked tremendously for him, but maybe it wouldn't do the next person as much good. I don't know. But thanks for your time.
Okay. Well, we come back to your recommendation, and I guess the mainline nutritionist recommendation is it is a healthy, balanced diet, the kind of diet that would make sense for anybody, mm-hmm. and that your concern would be with anything that is really out of the unusual that says eat a lot of one thing or don't eat any of another thing. Maybe there's anecdotal evidence that things like that can be a benefit, but there's not a lot of hard research that says things like that can be a benefit.
And until the research is there, I think we need to be cautious.
Well, there is a lot of information available about diabetes, and certainly if people have access to the Internet, there's lots of places they can go. They can go to the Diabetes Association, and I'm sure that it's out there, so if people want to educate themselves, that's certainly available. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if they have concerns, they should take that up with whoever they see for their health care.
Absolutely, they should.
Well, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest, Sandy Burke, she is a nurse practitioner. She's also a teaching associate in the U of I College of Nursing here in Urbana-Champaign at U of I. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods. Saturday, April 10th, World Harvest will hold a food tasting sampling foods from around the world to celebrate the 4th anniversary of their Champaign location and the opening of their new store in Columbia, Missouri. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign. The programming is also made possible today by grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. We are going to take a break as usual. We'll have some news 1 minute past the hour, but right now, an update on the markets.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
And with this commodity market update, I'm Tom Rogers. May wheat is currently on the Board of Trade at 412.5, up 4.5 cents. The July at 418.75, up 3. Also an update for corn and soybeans. May corn is at 325.25, up 5.25. July 331, up 5.5. September corn 328.25, up 8. December also up 8 at 320.